Chapter 3. From the Heart of the Storm. Hjold, the sea is set against us, for it is the sea, and the darkness is set about us, for it is the darkness. But we will row on, brothers, backs breaking into each stroke. We will row on because no other life or comfort awaits us. Fjarvoll, survive! The sea and the dark are our context. We will, before eternity, outrow all storms. From The Seafarer, Fenrisian Edda. The hull had been screaming for months, screaming like a newborn thrown to the night packs. Their ship was called the Waning Crescent, Zeta class, a courier ship. It was not the proud warship or long warp they might have hoped for, but they were a small company of wolves, and Leman Russ had no resources to waste. Fafner Bloodbroder had felt his heart swell with pride when Russ had given him the duty. It was a duty that had been handed to the 6th Legion by the Sigilite. However, Fafner had felt his heart sag when he realized it was not going to be some great, sharp-edged expedition of battleships and barges, but 10 wolf brothers on a lowly ship to distant Ultramar. Fafner had quickened his edge anyway, accepted the fold of parchment upon which his duty was laid out, and bowed to the Primarch of the 6th Legion. "O Jarl, I will do this, Lord," he had said. They had set out, sworn and dedicated to what was one of the most shocking duties any of the Legiones Astartes might ever undertake. 3 weeks into their voyage, the warp had gone dark, the storm had risen, and the ship had begun to scream. It had been screaming ever since. Most of the crew, the human crew, had gone mad. The wolves of Fenris had been forced to kill some, and deprive most of the others of their liberty for their own protection. The Waning Crescent, aside from 10 warriors of the 6th Legion Space Wolves, was carrying genestock grain samples and ceramics. Within a day, the violence of the warp storm had smashed all the ceramics in the holds. The screaming was... It was as if the world were ending. The bloody sunset of legend, the end of things, the wolf eating its own tail, the end of the great cycle, to be followed only by the cold moonrise of the afterworld. Fafner had been forced to tie the whimpering shipmaster to his seat. Bo Sorin, known as the Axe, had stood watch day and night over the navigator's socket pit, blade ready to administer mercy. Malmor Longreach, spear in one hand and bolter in the other, had guarded the defibrillating engines. Shockeye Finn, Kuro Jordrofk, Goodson Alfreya, Mads Lorison, and Salik the Braided had patrolled the empty companionways and echoing corridors of the stricken ship in rotation, watching for manifests. Biter Herrick had watched the fore station. Nido Knifeson had watched the stern quarters. None of them had gone unchallenged. The broiling warp had squeezed out demon forms, creatures that had pierced the screaming and slipped in through the hull plates of the ship. The wolves had been tasked. They had been forced to draw down, stand their ground, and bloody their blades to drive the warp things back. Malmor had fought 2 nights in the spastic engine room. Kuro had lost an arm to a tar-blackened maw that had swung in from nowhere. Biter Herrick had split a lunging skull in twain with his axe, and had done it every night to such an extent that it was almost a ritual. As the ship's master clock struck 4, the raging skull would appear at the fore station, and Biter would be ready with his axe to greet it and split it. They all had stories, pieces of a saga that none of them would ever live long enough to pass on to a scald for retelling. It was a voyage of the damned. They believed that each day marked out by the increasingly unreliable deck clocks of the battered ship would be their last. Then their voyage and their saga ended in the most unexpected way. Not in the jaws of the Doom Wolf or a drench of blood spilt by an enemy's blade or teeth. No, their saga ended in a light, in a beacon, in hope. Somehow, during the storm crossing, they had become friends. Aeron Cleave, of the 10th Legion Ironhands, black in his mourning cloak, and Timur Gantulga, of the 5th Legion Whitescars, pale as tundra frost. Their paths had crossed at Nerix, where Cleave's forces had been caught in flight after the Istvan massacre that had taken his beloved Primarch. A 60-day fight through the asteroid belt had finally ended when the Sons of Horus, snapping at Cleave's throat, were driven off by Gantulga's strike force. Word had already begun to spread of the War Master's treachery, and Gantulga's force had been hunting for targets. His remit had been to seek confirmation of the atrocity and its perpetrator, but Gantulga had found all the confirmation he needed in the sight of 8 warships bearing Horus's mark, hounding a battered barge of the 10th Legion like dogs baiting a wounded bear. The Sons of Horus had not gone quietly. Knowing their astropathic death screams would swiftly bring more of their kind, the Iron Hands and White Scars had formed up and made a run for Momed, where further Iron Hands were reported to be mustering. Gantulga had transferred to Cleave's barge to share intelligence data just before the assembled flotilla had entered the warp. Then the storm had struck, and they had been lost. Their crossing had begun. Gantulga did not count the hours or the days. It was fluid to him.
"Time is merely the distance between two objects," he said.
Cleave had no choice. Settings in his optical implants automatically displayed the track of local time. He would relate the tally to Gantulga, and the White Scar would shrug as if to note that while the data was practically meaningless, he appreciated the sharing. When the death of Ferus Manus had been authenticated, Cleave had decreed that his companies would observe 10 years of mourning. But as time was meaningless and fluid within the storm, and merely an arbitrary count in the corner of his vision, Cleave had also declared that the mourning would only begin once they were back in real space, within the flow of time as it is understood in the physical universe. It had become his obsession. Not deliverance or salvation, not to escape the storm, not even to find the enemy and avenge the fallen of his legion. He simply wanted to end the crossing and translate again so that he could reset his counter and begin the morning. That day, just another period marked for convenience on the shipboard watch, for the bucking, bridling ship travelled through the eternal storm blackness of the warp, Cleave found Gantulga in an upper wardroom, teaching Chagorian combat slang to some of Cleave's company and a party of remembrancers. Gantulga believed that there might be strategic benefits from having Iron Hands understand the private patois of the White Scars if they were to fight in close cooperation against a remorseless foe who otherwise knew all Imperial codings. The remembrancers were present to learn and then act as tutors for those in Cleave's company prevented from attending because of watch duties. Cleave had requested his remembrancers set aside their original role, a function that had been established to celebrate the glory of the Great Crusade. Since the treachery, there was nothing pure or worthy to remember. The only thing Cleave felt worth commemorating was the broken past before the fall, so the remembrancers had become willing memorialists. That day, which was just another meaningless mark in Cleave's stoic timekeeping, and just another non-day to Gantulga, would turn out to be a day to mark after all. The Iron Hands and the memorialists rose as Cleave entered the wardroom. Gantulga did not. Cleave addressed him directly. "There is a light," he said, "a beacon."
"This I have heard," said Gantulga.
"We steer towards it," said Cleave. "I have instructed the shipmaster so."
"Do we know if any of my ships are still with us?" asked Gantulga.
Cleave shook his head.
"Is it the light of terror, asked Gantulga, getting to his feet. "Is it the Astronomican Light of the Throne?"
Cleve shook his head again.
"The data is inconclusive. It seems unlikely. Analytically, its pattern is similar, but not the same. However, we are half-blind, and our senses are hardly reliable."
"We should steer towards it," Gantulga agreed.
He took out his long, slightly hooked sword and laid it on the table in front of him. He placed his palms flat on the surface beside it and made a silent oath of blessing to its trustworthiness and sharpness.
"You draw your sword?" asked Cleve.
"I am a hunter," replied Gantulga, "so I know how hunters operate. The light may be terror, it may be some other hope, but it may also be a lure. So let us go to this light, but let us do so armed until we know what it contains."
From the heart of the storm they came, over hours, then days, then weeks, lone ships, wounded vessels, broken flotillas, and piecemeal fleets. They were the lost and the damned, survivors and refugees, men fleeing battles or hunting for them, or simply voyagers seeking shelter from the madness of the ruin storm. And they came to Macragge, the light in the darkness. Some were ships bringing much-needed imports and materials from others of the 500 worlds. All brought news or pieces of news. Many were ships of Gilliman's own legion, storm-lost on their way back from the underworld war raging on Kalth, or the bitter campaign against the traitor suns that snarled across Ultramar as a whole. Some carried more of the wounded legions, the Iron Hands and Raven Guard, a handful of salamanders. The stories they brought were the bitterest of all.
"The audience hall is ready for you, Lord," said Yuton gently.
It was a daily practice. The Lord of Ultramar would personally greet representatives of the ships that the light had brought to Macragge. There was some solace and joy in this, sometimes the reunion of old comrades or the welcoming of a valuable asset. There was also grief and despair, however, and an ever-increasing tally of stories recounting infamy and loss. Gilliman thought his heart had been hardened by Kalth to the point at which it had fused like the heavy metal core of a star, inured to further pain, for a heart can only take a certain measure of pain before it ceases to feel. He had been wrong. He was studying a large-scale hololith display of the system's defences. Macragge and its orbital defences, the disposition of the Ultramar fleet elements, and the newly arriving masses of ships, the outer weapons platforms and void stations, the star forts and lunar stations, the barrages and decoy hulks, the swathes of mines, the mid-system watch stations, and sentry flotillas guarding the Mandeville Point, the prowling patrols, the patient battlecruisers, the automated batteries. With dabs of his fingers, he was making adjustments to certain lines and reordering ship positions. Yuton knew this was merely automatic tinkering, the distracted activity of a mind that barely had to concentrate to supervise such strategic complexity. She knew from long experience that Gilliman's mind was elsewhere.
"My lord."
Gilliman did not look up.
"Three dead," he said softly. "Lorgar's boasts were true. Three."
"My lord?"
Gilliman shook his head, eyes still on the display.
"The stories they bring to me, Yuton, that Horus or any of them should turn against us, against me, against my father, I cannot begin to process it. My only consolation at all, as I have learned through our bitter fight with Lorgar, is that something has overtaken them, contaminated them. The warp is in their brains. It hardly excuses their actions, but it explains them. They are run mad and are no longer of themselves."
He looked at the elderly chamberlain. She was upright and slender, supported by her tall staff. Her short hair was as glacial as her gown.
"It is a hard thing to accept, my lord," she said.
"I thought it would be the hardest," Gilliman agreed. "But what are brothers turned traitor compared to the death of three loyal sons? The survivors cannot refute it. Ferris is dead, Korax, Vulcan, loyal all, and dead. Then, from the mouths of others, this news from Prospero. Magnus defying our father so much that they set the damned wolves upon him. And now we hear from the Foul System, confirmation that Perturabo has indeed betrayed us."
He rose to his feet.
"What else? What else, I wonder? Is Terra already burning? Is my father already dead? If half of my brothers have turned to follow Horus's treachery, then who remains? Three of those who might be counted loyal are already dead. Who else? Where is the Khan? Does Dawn burn along with Terra? Sanguinius and his legion are said to be lost. The lion has gone into the dark. Have the traitors hunted down the Wolf King and torn him to shreds? Am I alone now?"
"My lord, you..." Gilliman held up his hand.
"I am just thinking out loud, ma'am. I will be composed by the time I reach the hall. You know I will."
She nodded.
"All I can count upon is what I know as solid fact," said Gilliman. "McCragg still stands. My legion still stands. While those two facts remain, there remains an Imperium."
He pulled a mantle around his broad, armoured shoulders and fixed the clasp at his throat. He was wearing the ceremonial version of his ferocious, clawed war gear and carried no weapons. For his daily custom of greeting those coming to his light out of the storm, he carried no personal weapons. Yutun watched her beloved lord fix the mantle. He looked more than ever like a monarch. Somehow the very lack of weapons made him seem more powerful.
"We are all we can count on," Gilliman said. "The time has long passed coming. We must declare. We cannot afford to lose any more time. We cannot afford to wait to hear if Terra endures or my father yet breathes. For the sake of mankind, as my father would have wished it, the Imperium begins again. Here. Now."
He walked towards the chamber door.
"And I will personally kill any bastard who tries to stop me,"